Breaking Bread is brought to you by North York Community House, an organization that builds strong, resilient, and inclusive communities in Northwest Toronto.
Shift. It's time for a shift. This is the shift.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. My name is Kadeen Bankasing, and I'll be your host for this episode of Breaking Bread, Stories of Black Communities in Transition. Our limited podcast series seeks to take a deeper dive into redevelopment and uncover the truth about this phenomenon in the city of Toronto. Throughout this journey, we'll be speaking to residents, community leaders, and industry experts who'll shed light on the experiences of those living through these major transitions and take a deeper dive into the real consequences of urban redevelopment. This is episode 6 of Breaking Bread, Stories of Black Communities in Transition. Last week on our podcast, we began unpacking heritage in the city of Toronto. Today, we're going to continue that conversation with Gary Miedema. Let's dive in.
Who evaluates and designates the areas of heritage and cultural significance in Toronto, which I think you started to speak to. So if you want to elaborate, go ahead. But here's the second part of it as well. And is this process for evaluation and designation, is there room and space, or even how is community already involved in that?
So I want to start again with that question to say there are various within communities people will evaluate what is important to the history of their communities, right? So again, I think there's many ways of determining what is heritage, and there's many people determining that. Heritage Toronto has its reasons for doing what it does. Museums have their reasons for doing what we do. Historical societies will focus on one thing and not on the other. I mean, that's the amazing thing about history, is that history is really the whatever slice of the past that we're particularly interested in, and then how we find those stories, right? So that evaluation is happening everywhere in the city all the time by many, many people. Our piece of the pie is heritage planning, which is really, I think, what you're interested in terms of buildings and places. Mm-hmm. So we've got a number of tools that I'll back up and talk about. And I think I do want to talk about that provincial criteria a bit too, because that'll help, I think, narrow down.
Absolutely.
So here's where we dip into law. And as a framework for what we do. And I think whenever you're going to talk to a city staffer in particular, what you will eventually get down to is what is the legislation that allows us to do what we do, right? Because we can only act based on what either council has allowed us to do and said, please do this, or what provincial legislation allows us to do. So the provincial legislation that allows us to do the very specific task of heritage that we do, which is identify places that meet provincial criteria, put them on the register so we can conserve them going forward.
Okay.
That's the very specific piece that our unit does. Mm-hmm. We are empowered to do that by the Ontario Heritage Act. Mm-hmm. You can Google it. It's all there. It's actually not that messy to read through. But what it does do is it lays out how we do what we do, the processes for doing what we do. And then it also, through Regulation 906, and there's the technical term, mm-hmm. But this is the regulation that gives us the criteria we use. So I'm going to try to hold on to a thread here, but we'll talk about the criteria first. So the provincial criteria that we've been given come in three big buckets. And this is always interesting for people to understand too, because I think often when people think of a heritage building, they think of design, mm-hmm. architecture, right? So it's going to be old city hall or the lovely old bank building on the corner, you know, with some nice stonework, or, you know, so we tend to think very quickly of design, of landmarks, of that type of building. There's three subcategories in that, but that in that big category of design, that's really what it's about. We're talking about design excellence, or is this building not just an outstanding, unique building? It doesn't have to be that. Is it representative of a particular type of building? Is it a good representative of a particular type of building? It could be conserved for that reason as well. So that's design. So the second piece is, and this is, I think, where it starts to get more interesting, is that a property can be considered to have heritage value because of its historical or associative values. So there's design. Now we're not talking about design anymore. We're not even talking about what the building looks like. Mm-hmm. We're talking about what's the history of this building and who are the organizations, individuals, institutions of significance to a community that are related to that building. So the obvious one might be to think of in terms of design is an architect. And that's not because of the design, but it's because this is a really important architect, right? So, you know, there are big architects in the history of the city. E.J. Lennox is one of them. He designed Old City Hall. If you find a building by E.J. Lennox, it's kind of throw on the brakes, right? Let's look at this really carefully because he's an important architect. So it could have that kind of significance, but it can also have significance because of a really that it was very important to a community for a particular period of time for a particular reason, and that importance is such that even if the building doesn't look like much, it's important just because of what happened in it, right? So that can be a reason to conserve a building. Yes. Or a place. I shouldn't just keep saying buildings. It's also a place. It could be a landscape. So the third one is contextual value. And that means essentially, how does a property support or maintain or even define the character of an area? Is it a landmark? Is one easy way to think about it. So it could be that building is important just because it is, you know, for many, many, many years, it's just been there and we all know it and love it as that's the building on the corner of blank and blank, right? So these landmarks, it just help to define a sense of place of where we are. Yes. So that's a kind of landmark value, but it could also be that the building is not grand or, you know, significantly an outstanding design all on its own, but it's a part of a cluster of buildings that help form the character of a neighborhood. So we have recently been looking at main streets, the old main streets in the city, like the Danforth, right? Where you have a lot of those two-story, three-story commercial buildings. Any one of those buildings, you might walk past and go, it's a two-story, you know, commercial building. But when they're in significant groups or clusters together, they help to really tell that story of the Danforth, right? Yeah. And of how it was built. So every community kind of has some of those places as well, right? That are just a part of the character of the area. So those are the criteria that are given to us by the province. And the job that we have, and I'll talk about who we are in a second, the job that we have then is to research, engage with communities, and take whatever we learn and put them through that criteria and say, does this meet the standard for, or does this merit significance in a way that we can say to council, yes, this is, and then we write a significant staff report. You can look all those up. They're all online. They're buried in the city system. I could point you to that with a link and you can read. Some of them are 40 pages. Some of them are 60 pages and they kind of tell the story of this is why this building is important. Those criteria and the reports are really important because, as you can imagine, on the one side of heritage, we have the heritage advocates, the local community folks, people who just know the history of the community and want it conserved. And on the other side, we have the property owners who, when we make a property, when we say a property is on the heritage register, suddenly now have a new process and new rules that they have to deal with. And property owners are not always excited, as you can imagine, about having to learn a whole other system and work through another process that helps to conserve their property. So this is a legal process. It's not just an honorific. Mm-hmm. It means that if we say, if city council says this building is heritage, it means that how that property changes, there will be some restrictions on that.
Yeah. It's going to fall within some kind of,
Exactly.
Yeah.
It can change, but there will very likely be restrictions on how it can change. Mm-hmm. So the folks who are doing this work in our unit, we've got a unit of about 25 people. We come from a bunch of different educational backgrounds. I would say a number of us are trained as urban planners, urban designers with a heritage interest. A number of us, like me, come to it with PhDs in history. Some have specific training in public history or heritage conservation and specific degrees in that. We have two archaeologists on our term because archaeology is a part of what we do. So there's really, I think, a big spectrum of how you could become a heritage planner, which is what our designations are really. And it's this team, again, half of us are involved in the research and evaluation side and the recommendation side, and half of us are involved on the side of, okay, now a property's on the register and a property owner wants to either put a condominium on the site or do an addition on the back of their house or change their front porch, or, you know, the level of detail, right, can be very broad. And that team is responsible for looking at why the building is important, and then looking at what the changes are and trying to find a way of working with the owner to do the change they want to do, and but also make sure that the property is appropriately conserved. Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm really interested then to understand if...
Oh, community, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, just to say, because part of what my work has been around community engagement and having, you know, residents and others involved in these processes, right?
Yeah, so absolutely.
How do you work with, how does heritage planning work with community in this conversation of heritage?
Yeah, excellent. So I would say, first of all, we have a process called, so the Toronto Heritage Survey, which is what I've been in, has been, again, trying to build a process that we can take citywide that allows us to look at a whole area in order to understand what in that area might have heritage value. So that, and I'll position this in contrast to what has happened often in the past, is property A has a development application on it. It looks like it might have heritage. Here, quick, heritage planning team, look at it. Does it have heritage? Right. Mm-hmm. So everything's a rush. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at this building, but you're trying to look at it in the context of everything else, but you've got a limited time to do it because it's part of a development application. So a better way that we're trying to get ahead of that pressure is to do a systematic survey of an area that allows us to have time to more thoroughly engage with communities, understand what they value, and look at buildings as a part of that larger context of the community. So with regards to engagement in that, engagement is a really critical part. And I'll say it this way, and this is really, I can also forward you a link for the Toronto Heritage Survey report so you can see what we're proposing to do in that. We recognize that as heritage staff, we are technical experts in applying provincial criteria and in doing the job that we do in terms of evaluating properties, doing the research on the properties. We are not experts in how communities value their properties. Mm-hmm. So in Lawrence Heights, we don't know what the community thinks is important. So, and in the past, it would be an architectural historian would kind of walk through the community and go, doesn't meet the standard of architectural significance, or it does, and it would go on the register. We're trying to emphasize much more in our process that historical associative part of the criteria, not just design, and also contextual part, right? So we're trying to better understand properties in their context and also understand how they might be significant to a community. The only way we know that is if we engage with communities, right? Mm-hmm. And if we give communities opportunities to tell us what they think is important. And that's really why it's a pleasure for me to be here today, because I think part of that is communities need us to help them understand our criteria, right? And how what they tell us can feed into that criteria. Mm-hmm. We need to have the opportunity to listen and then to take what we hear and apply it to the criteria, then come back to communities and say, this is what we've done. What do you think, right? So we have this process now, a heritage survey. One will be done in Little Jamaica, and that work is ongoing right now, and they're happening in lots of other regions. We're also in the middle of one in Jane and Finch right now, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we typically hire folks outside of our staff team because there's so much work to be done. So we look for consultants, essentially, who are heritage professionals who can help us understand the built form, how it's come to be, the development of that area, right? And that's through mapping and looking at assessment records and land surveys and all that technical work. We can figure out which building was built when, by whom, and you know how that community came to be. But again, we don't know the lived experience of people in those buildings and how that history of those buildings may have shaped what might be valuable or what were not. So there's that second stream of really emphasizing engagement and consultation with local communities. Mm-hmm. And we do that through heritage focus groups. Mm-hmm. So what we do when we come into a community is we're starting to apply this as a best practice, and we're doing it in Jane Finch, we're doing it in other communities now. We try to look at the census data, first of all, to say who's here. Mm-hmm. And then we try to, through that process and working with the community, identify individuals who reflect that community and its diversity, who can join a heritage focus group. And that focus group is intended to be not professional historians, not even people who might call themselves local historians, but it could be someone who has lived there for the last 40 years, right? And just has lived the experience. And we use those groups as an early opportunity for them to tell us, this is what they know about the story, and for us to reflect back to them, this is what we've learned, what are we missing, right? And so we can kind of have a first glimpse of how it's going. We then move from the heritage focus group into a larger community meeting, often through planning studies. And you've been a part of some of those for Lawrence Heights, right? Where we can come back to a larger group of citizens, open door, and say, hey, what do you think? And then we've also started to do individual interviews. So for those folks who have so much knowledge and they don't want to sit in a meeting or a heritage focus group, we are doing interviews to sit down with them and say, tell us about the history of this community and what you think is value. So, you know, if it's in Jane Finch, we're looking for, you know, knowledge keepers in that community to say, there's a significant Vietnamese community in Jane Finch, which is not maybe what we think about when we think of Jane Finch. What did they value, right? Are there places that were really important to them that we need to know about? And of course, that's apart from, again, the Black African Caribbean communities in Jane Finch, or, you know, and et cetera. So it's really trying to be more proactive about seeking out those stories. And we're on a curve to get there. This is, as you may know, in engaging communities, it's hard work. Yeah. And you don't do it quick a minute, right? It takes a lot of time and effort and resources to do it well. So I won't say we're doing it perfectly at all, but I think we're recognizing the work that needs to be done, and we're really trying to get there to do it. So that's through those studies and how we go about it. So we hear from communities, we have our experts looking at design, we put all that information together, we go through the criteria, and then we come back to the communities to say, okay, here's what we know about the communities, here's our summary of its history, and then here's the list of properties that we think merit conservation coming out of that list. What do you think? We get the feedback there. And then I'm not done, but we've got a couple of, there's a more, now we enter into a more bureaucratic process, I would say, where the city also has a committee structure. And again, you may be familiar with this, but Heritage has its own citizen advisory group called the Toronto Preservation Board.
Yes.
And we are mandated under the Ontario Heritage Act and under the city's municipal code to say whatever we're going to recommend to council, we first recommend through the Toronto Preservation Board. Mm-hmm. And the Toronto Preservation Board is an advisory group, volunteers appointed by council, who give advice to council. They don't decide, they give advice, right? Council makes the decision. So we'll go to the Toronto Preservation Board. That's a wide open meeting. Anyone is welcome to come. Challenge for many communities is they don't know what's happening, don't know how to access it, recognize all those issues, right? But it is intended to be, it is a public meeting, let me put it that way. And then the next layer is it goes to Toronto, or it goes to one of the community council meetings. And again, I expect maybe you've been to one of those meetings. It's another public meeting, an opportunity for people to depute if they so wish, write letters, emails.
Yep.
And then it goes to council. So that's the flow of decision making. So there are many points for people to gain access to and contribute to that process. Mm-hmm. Key question, which I understand, is do people know about that process? And do they know how to access it? Do they have the technology to access it? Recognize all those concerns and issues. But that's how the process flows and how public engagement is a part of it.
Thank you so much for that. And clearly, you know, even in just your synopsis of these different stages and processes, right, it's already very detailed. And that's an overview. Now imagine having to navigate through that, determine which points you're able to access. And yeah. I'm speaking this as somebody who is in the community saying, hey, this is, you know, something that we're interested in being involved in or want to explore or interact with more closely because there's something that's important to us there.
So I'll say, and I hear that. And I think this is why we're also, and I think city planning in general is getting better at this. There was a time again when there was a billboard put up in the community saying, and a notice that mails around, there's going to be a community meeting at this time and this night.
Yep.
If you come, great. If you don't, sorry, we're moving on. Right. And I think all of us are really in a movement of trying to be much more proactive mm-hmm. about making sure that we offer more opportunities in a wider variety of ways for people to contribute mm-hmm. What they think and to inform the process. And again, it's a huge ongoing challenge, but it's one that we're working on.
So. Yeah, no, and I appreciate as well just hearing you say that we're conscientious of this, because that, of course, we recognize it and we're taking steps to be able to do that more effectively, because that is really what people are, you know, are hoping for. From an engagement perspective, we know that those meetings or those notices that you get in the mail, as we call them, they're checkbox engagement, like, you know, spaces we check that yes, we did some community engagement, whether it was effective, whether it was inclusive or not, but it was done, right? So we understand that is generally being the flow of processes. So recognizing that yes, there are individuals like yourself, whole departments within our kind of municipal body are saying no, we are aware of this also is like a major step of in the right direction too. So this is good for us.
But you know what, and I would say we are, so as a city, we are certainly, it is expected of us as city planners and heritage planners or city planners, we're part of the division, it's expected of us that we engage. Mm-hmm. And so we have to do it, we know that. But it is, and we have to sometimes do it in a certain way. There are certain engagements that that the legislation says you must do. Right, like the Toronto Preservation Board, or like a large community meeting for a planning study. You know, there has to be a kind of statutory meeting. Mm-hmm. I think that those of us in city planning that I've known that I've worked with are all trying to those are checkbox only in that the legislation requires it. But those are real opportunities. And I think that the regret is that communities have experiences in the past where it was a checkbox, right? They said something and it was ignored. Mm-hmm. But I would just want to send the message out that these are also real opportunities to make your voice heard. Mm-hmm. And they require time and resources. You've got to have childcare if you can make it to that evening meeting, or, you know, there are all kinds of barriers that I think we're also aware of. And you know, the Jane Finch engagement process is working with a local community, the Jane Finch Center, to help engage. And, mm-hmm. and we're trying to think through what how we can, you know, access youth and get youth to contribute through particular means at different times, how we can do pop-ups. We're trying to do all kinds of things to come to the community and to make it easier. Mm-hmm. I would just want to encourage folks to know that what we can only also work with what we hear. Mm-hmm. And when we, you know, we really want to do our best. We need to hear from communities when we're not doing our best with ideas about how we could do better. Absolutely. Please do come out and contribute what you can, because that's the only way we can hear as city staff.
Yes. No, I think that point that you just made is so valuable, because what we, and again, and from community, we're also thinking, how can we motivate and encourage participation, because we recognize it's absolutely tough. Necessary. It's hard, but on the flip side of it, when people are saying, oh, we don't get what we need, we also want to say, hey, well, we've got to also be willing to put ourselves into spaces that are created to for our voices, right? So, you know, this relationship to those processes as well, because there's been trust broken, you know, we want to repair those. And I think part of why we are having these conversations and doing this podcast is to encourage and motivate, help demystify the technical aspects of the process, to encourage participation and involvement, because it is important, right? Like, if we can let people know that this heritage process, yes, it requires a lot for heritage designation to happen. But in fact, if you have identified or feel strongly that this space is should be considered, well, then we know what we need to be doing to make that happen, or the steps that we can take to do that. So there's a lot for us to learn from each other, I think, in that way. So
absolutely.
Yeah, it's great. I have one last question, if you have just a few more minutes.
Of course.
And this one, because you really spoke to kind of heritage legislation at the provincial level, is centered on the real property, the physical lots.
Yeah.
Structures in various categories, but yes, very much on the buildings. And so I'm wondering if there's any legislation, process, or initiatives in place that conserves or protects the intangible heritage, you know, that people probably are saying is really what is important to us, you know, when we're thinking about communities or certain spaces in the city.
So you're absolutely right that our provincial legislation says that we can only protect quote unquote real property. Mm-hmm. Something essentially that you can touch, that's kind of permanently affixed to something as well, right? So sometimes we can't even protect signage, because mm-hmm. signage can be taken off and replaced with something else, right? Mm-hmm. So that restriction to real property is real, and it's a challenge for us as planners, because we hear communities saying, but it's about more than the building, right? And that challenge is beyond heritage planning. It's through city planners, because again, we're empowered by legislation that only lets us do so much. Yep. And part of what communities are really interested in is the use of the building, right? So I want that restaurant that's been in my community for 50 years to stay, because it's more than a restaurant. It's a community hub, right? So there's that recognition that there are businesses, private businesses, that are more than money-making ventures to a community. It's the hardware store in your community, or who knows what it is. So we, with our heritage tools, can't protect use. We can only protect
the building, the
mm-hmm. real property. Okay. Mm-hmm. We recognize that gap. There is no existing heritage tool that can protect use. Mm-hmm. But what we have been doing is looking across, again, the city. And this is where looking from one division to another. If you're and it again depends on what you're thinking about as heritage. If you're thinking about heritage as a building, we have the tool. We can protect a building, right? As long as it merits that that protection. If you're thinking about art and music, what about the economic development and culture? What are the music programs? Right? Is there funding for a local festival? Is there, and that's not an easy road, I get it, for communities to navigate grants and funding and what's available out there. But there are programs in the city, like cultural hotspots, for example, that do really value that local engagement and local experience. So, there's that broader spectrum of what is it that you're interested in heritage, and then thinking outside of heritage planning for sure, in terms of now where might be there some funding to help us support that. And it may not be called heritage funding, right? Yeah. It might be music arts. But I'd also say, and I think this is, I've been doing a lot of thinking over the last number of years about this too. And it's thinking for me about how the intangible values, and by intangible, we generally refer to things that aren't fixed down, that aren't permanent, right? That will disappear with time. So it could be ideas. Mm-hmm. It could be dance, something that's performed once and never performed again, or needs to be continually performed, right? But it can move. It could be foodways and food cultures. That some of those things, and it could be relationships, right? Mm-hmm. And some of those things are actually informed by the spaces that they operate in and have a connection to those places. So where that connection exists in a meaningful way, that's historical associative value for us, right? Mm-hmm. So again, and sometimes the places, the buildings, the landscapes need to be conserved because they are a tangible link to something, right? Mm-hmm. There's a coming together sometimes of place and things that aren't fixed in heritage that can be really meaningful. So I'm really interested in understanding more of that too, and that's where we need to hear from communities about. Mm-hmm. What they value, and then we as people who work with those regulations all the time and understand what generally is understood to fit that criteria and what it isn't, we can work with communities to try to understand, does that merit conservation of the building? And then the second question is, if it doesn't, what other tools are there, and to your point, right, that the city could provide that might be available for people to conserve that point? Sometimes it's a walking tour. So it might be an oral history project, might be a podcast, right? What you're doing that can help to capture some of those pieces.
Thank you so much, because your last point just made me feel very hopeful in a way of like, yeah, there's a lot of creativity that could be, that can or should become a part in how we start to even think about preservation. Preservation of heritage in that way, you know, and the festival, right, that happens every year, that brings people together, that commemorates and and preserves memory, that's just as valuable as the monument, you understand? Yeah. That stands, yeah. That structure. So that made me actually feel very hopeful in a moment like
good
our thoughts around heritage in our communities, right, is something that we need to expand and grow as well. And how we do that with, you know, being able to learn more deeply on how it works can be really, really valuable for us as well. And how we start to think about and explore with it and or work with our departments and divisions and, you know, others who make this work happen and make the decisions happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was very encouraging in that moment. So
I'm glad to hear it. And so, you know, again, I can follow up with some links to some of these other units in the city to Heritage Toronto. I'd love to see a walking tour. I don't know if there has been one from Heritage Toronto and Lawrence Heights, but there should be, maybe they could add a walking tour to their program and raise awareness about the Heritage of Lawrence Heights, right? So there's it all takes time and effort from communities, which I've come to deeply respect, right? A lot of people volunteer in this world, but
When we start to think about the relationship, for instance, of the Allen Road to the city, to Jane Jacobs and to Lawrence Heights, there's a real history there in how people residents that I know who have lived in the community for a long time feel, knowing that the Allen created a divide. right? Like literally a real tangible divide, physical divide in the community. So yeah, it's, you know, again, when you start to now see heritage, and even just for me in this conversation, in this time that we've had to get together, Gary, like as something that's beyond this idea that, no, we've got to erect monuments, right? None of the buildings are going to stay in Lawrence Heights, but no, we need monuments, we need walls, we need these other things, that suddenly that become, it grows, it has expanded, because there are, you know, are other ways that we can explore preserving heritage and the stories around Lawrence Heights, as an example, as a community, through its redevelopment process. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
This is the shift, big change, big things in the phase. Yeah. Big change, big things in the phase. Yeah. Big change, big things in the phase. Yeah. In the phase. Yeah. This is the shift. Vibration.
This podcast is brought to you by North York Community House. North York Community House built strong, resilient, and inclusive communities in Northwest Toronto. We help children, youth, parents, and seniors become active, engaged citizens who lead positive change in their neighborhoods. Find us at nych.ca.